It's hard to believe the Mission Impossible movie franchise goes all the way back to 1996. More than 20 years later, the sixth film in the series is Mission Impossible Fallout.
In it, Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt is trying to recover some plutonium. And as always, he's defending himself against accusations of disloyalty. He's joined by Henry Cavill, as well as familiar cast members like Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg. And of course, some rubber masks. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're taking to the streets, the skies, the water, and the glitzy high-class nightclubs to talk about Mission Impossible Fallout on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And with us in our fourth chair, of course, film critic, theater critic, and our ambassador of punching,
living manifestation of destiny. Please, please just read what's on the paper, Linda.
Living manifestation of destiny, Chris Klimek. How are you, Chris?
Hello. I'm very excited to talk about this movie.
Chris is very excited to talk about this movie, and we're going to get to him in a minute because Chris really loves these movies. And Chris and I have gone back and forth about a variety of action franchises, but we're going to get to Chris. I'm going to start with Glenn, actually. I consider that you are neither a I love all action movies or I hate all action movies kind of person. So tell me how you liked this one.
This movie gives you exactly what you want out of it. What I like about this franchise is that it's very sincere. It's not knowing or smarmy about doing what it does. It just does it. And it's clever. And on a purely physical, like adrenaline level, it's often kind of astonishing. Nothing about this feels faked or cheated, so it takes you back to a time when you'd sit and marvel at a stunt as opposed to just appreciate how it looks. You know, you'd wonder about the danger behind it in a way that now that a lot of these stunts are CGI, you don't anymore. It's more talky and convoluted than it needs to be, as always. I do think that's intentional. I think that's how you avoid the kind of Fast and Furious piling ridiculous on top of ridiculous by giving the audience some breathing room. I would say that I'm living proof that you can not have seen Rogue Nation or, in my case, completely forgotten everything about Rogue Nation and still get by in this film.
No, we saw Rogue Nation together.
Yeah, I don't remember any of it.
Yeah.
But you can get by. It probably would help to have a refresher. But yeah, I dug it.
All right. What'd you think, Stephen?
I'm in somewhat of the same boat. I think that these are enormously skillfully made. I think Tom Cruise is an incredibly game action movie star at 56. He, you know, did a lot of his own stunts, broke his ankle in the process of making this one.
Shot is in the movie.
It is kind of viscerally exciting. A lot of these stunts are enormously well played. I do find with, for some reason, specifically with these movies, I don't know a single thing about the Tom Cruise character. It's not just that I forget them from movie to movie, but I don't have a sense of what he's about in these movies as they're happening. I just don't think about him or his character at all. And I think, I know it's silly. The movie is called Mission Impossible, but there is a certain amount of, like, arms folded. That wouldn't happen. That goes into these movies because, in part, with this movie in particular, there's kind of a running motif of, like, I'm just gonna wing it. I'm just gonna see what happens and do my best. And then they embark on the most Byzantine chase. It just winds up something you would need months and months and the best luck in the world to execute to the precision, the Swiss watch precision that happens here when you've been told, oh, we did that in 2 hours.
Yeah.
that I do kind of find myself getting pulled out of it again and again. But at the same time, like, it's fun. It's, you're in good hands.
Yeah. And I think the stunts are fantastic in this movie. Like, I was incredibly impressed by the action scenes in the film. I was incredibly impressed by the inventiveness of a couple of the sequences in particular. I think the closing action sequence in this is as good as any you're going to see. It is inventive and interesting. And I do think Stephen raises an interesting question. When you bring up plausibility, it's fair to ask, what's the contract that this film is making with you? Because on the one hand, of course, it's supposed to be silly and broad and over the top, and that's action movies for you. But on the other hand, I also feel like they always are trying to introduce a little bit of gravitas into these films. They want you to kind of take all of this in a weird way seriously, in a way that I think, for example, Skyscraper doesn't ask you to. Chris, I've been holding.
Yes, right.
Just waiting to uncork.
Of course. Well,
I
don't know that I consider Skyscraper the appropriate comparison because I will always prefer, I mean, as much as I like to watch a bad action movie and kind of chuckle along at it, I will always prefer one that tries. You know, and I mean, this movie took like four times as long to make as Skyscraper did, and you can sort of see that. Weirdly, I have become more of an apostle for this series as it has been slowly undoing all of the things that I always considered its strengths. I saw all these films as they were released in theaters, and I liked them, but I wasn't, like, crazy about them. But I liked that there was a different director each time and that the tone seemed to change. So with the last three, Ghost Protocol, Fallout, and Rogue Nation, the grade of the movies has just gone up.
Yeah.
Chris McQuarrie is the first director to return for a second film. I mean, he apparently did an uncredited rewrite on Ghost Protocol. And he has kind of become Tom Cruise's guy. And I will want to, after we go around again, kind of talk about this late stage Tom Cruise career where he has sort of retreated into action films exclusively, but I think is great at them. And it's sort of weird that he pivoted that direction when he was about 40.
Yeah, I think he's great at them too. At the same time, he's a better actor than these films ask of him.
Sure.
And I don't just mean that with some of the sort of Oscar-nominated Born on the 4th of July, what people think
Magnolia.
Of, what people think of as kind of his most serious films, but even the range of sort of comedy and glibness, but seriousness that you get in more kind of ordinary populist dramas like A Few Good Men, in which he's really funny a lot of the time, and also really you get a kind of a take on that glib smugness that's kind of part of him. I miss him doing more than he does in these films. Because I
miss him exhibiting any personality characteristics.
Well, I think this is why we all loved Edge of Tomorrow so much, right?
Yes.
And Chris McQuarrie also fixed that movie.
100%. And I agree with Steven that you can watch six of these movies in a few days, as I did, and you still just feel like there's grittily concerned and then there's grittily determined.
Yeah.
And those are the two settings, right? He's either in the sort of like, oh gosh, what am I going to do?
Resolute and worried.
Well, exactly. So I think this is an underuse of him in that way.
Yeah, there's a passage toward the end of this film where the character of Ethan Hunt has to do a thing he's never done before, and of course he does it well. But they allow a little bit of that Edge of Tomorrow doubt and lack of just blank cipher confidence.
Yeah.
Well, that has come into these last few films, particularly by adding Simon Pegg or Jeremy Renner, who's not in this movie, as the sort of, you know, more relatable character who's like you're going to do what? You know, what are you doing? And I think that is a really smart way of Tom Cruise, comma, producer, managing the Tom Cruise persona, you know, as he is increasingly perceived in real life as kind of a crazy guy, making that the character, I think, and I agree with you, Stephen, that Ethan Hunt has always been a blank slate, and I've always kind of been fine with that. You know, I like that he was just an action figure, and I kind of thought, like, I never wanted to learn anything about his personal life or his backstory or anything, and I was a little, when J.J. Abrams came in, is like, well, now we need to give him a fiance and have him think about quitting the impossible mission business, and I was like, I don't know that I really want it to go that way, but
I don't know that I want him to exhibit any humanity.
Well, clearly, that was
I barely
not
want
a
him to have articulated elbows.
Right. No. Oh boy. Let's talk about those elbows, because to me, and I, this is where I'm going to push back on you saying that he is overqualified as an actor. Am I putting words in your mouth?
No, I think that's right. I think he's overqualified.
Because I think my thinking on this has changed over the years. In the same way that I used to think Keanu Reeves was a bad actor, and I don't think that anymore. You know, physicality is part of the performance.
Oh,
and
of course.
That, I can understand that for many viewers, the insisting on doing his own stunts, insisting on doing his own parachute jumping, insisting on doing his own helicopter flying, Paramount is all in saying that that was really Tom Cruise flying the helicopter during the dogfight at the end of this movie, that he spent 2,000 hours becoming a commercially rated helicopter pilot. Do we believe it? They're putting a lot into that. So I don't know. But to me, like, he is a Gene Kelly, Buster Keaton level physical performer. And does not get enough credit for that. Like, to me, watching Tom Cruise run, it is like watching Gene Kelly dance, it is like watching Bruce Lee fight, it is like watching Vin Diesel wear sunglasses indoors.
I get it, and I get it. You know, I appreciate the fact that when he is running in an action scene, he books.
Yeah.
And I think that is great.
He is the same age Roger Moore was in Octopussy.
I don't
and
even,
look at him go.
I don't even care about that, because I'm not talking about speed. I'm talking about effort. Mm-hmm. I think there are too few people in action movies who you can tell are running absolutely as fast as they can, partly because it's complicated to keep the camera with you. It's complicated to keep the scene going. So sometimes you get the sense that you're looking at a person who's not actually running as fast as they could be running. And maybe he isn't, but he looks like he is. And I get that, and I appreciate that, and I think you're absolutely right. I agree with you about the Gene Kelly comparison. I'm not sure that running...
Gene Kelly's a better dancer.
Gene Kelly dances better.
I'll give you that. Running is quite the same thing,
but I get the comparison that you're making.
One thing that this franchise has, that no other action franchise has, of course, is Lalo Schifrin's theme.
Yeah.
And that thing, man, I got two ears and a heart. When that comes on, the soundtrack, I sit up in my seat, and I am enjoying what I'm watching 30% more, 30 to 32% more.
Yes, I agree.
It's powerful.
I agree. And you know what the best part is? It's not the actual part. It's not the part that goes dun, 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 dun. It's the part before that where it goes, that's the part where I go, oh, I'm excited.
All right, well, I think that like scoring in this genre is not discussed enough. And I think that is actually one of the keys to Die Hard, which we have discussed endlessly. So we don't need to talk about the Beethoven being threaded through the Die Hard score again, right? But I think just that elevates that movie so much. We haven't mentioned Rebecca Ferguson yet, who again is a returning cast member in this film, that playing the type of character who previously in the series would be just, you know, we'd never heard from again after one movie, who I think is a great, great, great action hero. Apparently not someone who had done any stunts or fighting or anything prior to being cast in this series. She's introduced in the opera sequence in the prior movie where they're going to see Tarando.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you see her in Rogue Nation, we get a little bit of that opera on the score, which is great. You know, you don't have to notice that. And maybe that's even what, you know, people are talking about when they accuse this series of pretension. But like, there are so many just Easter eggs like that that contribute to my enjoyment. You know, these films are not deep. They're not really about anything. You know, they are superbly executed entertainments, blue chip diversions.
Yeah, I do think this one has one or two more pieces than it needs. I think it's a little too long. I think it has too many reversals. There are too many points when they try to say, but wait, you get to the point where it's like, all right. Like, I like a simple action movie that I can sort of stay with one bad guy and good guy and then through line.
This is not your series then, because they're all kind of confusing, but, except for two.
Well, like I said, I watched all of them in a period of 3 days. And the point is, they are, this one more than the other ones, not only does it keep flipping back and forth and adding people and all that stuff, but it has an entire character, I would argue, played by Vanessa Kirby, who is unnecessary in every way. And there's, other than the fact that they want to have a femme fatale in a slinky dress, there's no reason for her to be in the movie. Stephen Thompson, question number one. Tell me things.
You were talking about how unnecessarily complicated these movies can get. At the same time, so many of these movies, including into superhero action movies, have these villains that boil down to, like, for something good to happen, something really bad has to happen.
Yeah.
And we're going to make that really bad thing happen. Mm-hmm. That is kind of the villain motivation equivalent of, Linda, what you talk about with the there's a box, everyone wants the box.
Sure.
Like, you can basically shorthand it at this point that the villains just want something bad to happen.
Yeah.
Instead, you get this kind of endless talky talk about, like, we get it.
Here, though, there's a scene, a long scene, where Ving Rhames explains the plot of the last two or three films. And it's like, why, like, this film is capable of doing that kind of stuff so economically.
Yeah.
There's a completely unnecessary skydive that they don't need to do. There's no reason
for it. There's no story reason, but it is the best skydive you've ever seen in an action movie.
Except for that reason, yes. I mean, it looks great, but it also does some character work on the way down. You learn things about the characters from that. That's hugely, that works. And then we just have sitting around with Ving Rhames as he talks about love.
Well, and the thing is, Ving Rhames is a real actor. This is what frustrates me. I think Ving Rhames is a real actor and is particularly underserved by some of what goes on in this film. I will reveal that there is a moment, I will not reveal when or why, but there is a moment when he says, in these words, I'm sure he has a reason, but what? No one talks like that. Nobody talks like that. That's really bad dialogue. And I think, for me, I very much enjoyed this movie. And the only thing that made me enjoy it a little bit less was that the hype coming out of the first screenings of it was so, to me, over the top and hyperbolic of, like, he's the greatest movie star ever. This is the greatest franchise ever. Like, nah, it's good.
But we'll get solid. The backlash this week. So,
yeah.
you know, that'll correct itself.
It's solid. I think it's a really good film. I don't know. think it's a really good
film. Yeah, it's a really good film.
So that's Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise and Robert Redford and Meryl Streep, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I very much liked it, and I would be interested in hearing what all of you think about it. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week. Oh, and also every week, what's making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Wix.com, a web platform for creating your own professional website. With Wix, whether it's your first time creating a website or you're a longtime pro, you can do it yourself. Choose from hundreds of stunning templates or start from scratch with drag-and-drop technology and powerful web features. Join over 125 million people already using Wix to create their own websites. Go to Wix.com to create yours today. So what will you create? Support for NPR and the following message come from Hotel Tonight. Hotel Tonight partners with hotels to help them sell their unsold rooms, which means you get incredible deals. And it isn't just for last-minute bookings. You can book for tonight, tomorrow, and beyond. It's the go-to app whether you're a planner or a procrastinator. You can lock down your vacation plans now or play it by ear. To start finding great deals at great hotels, download the Hotel Tonight app now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Last summer, NPR Music put together a blockbuster omnibus package called Turning the Tables, a really remarkable collection of writing and curation, highlighting the 150 greatest albums by women. Very ambitious project. On Monday, July 30th, NPR Music is launching its sequel, Turning the Tables 2, the turn...
Tables are.
Focusing entirely on the music of the 21st century across every imaginable genre, more than 60 contributors, again curated by the great and good Ann Powers. Really, really excited about the project. The reason I am bringing it up prior to the launch is that there are two events in New York City that if you happen to be in the New York area, I would love it if you checked out. There is a panel discussion at the New York Library for the Performing Arts with a tremendous selection of journalists and NPR contributors. Google that. And then on Wednesday, August 1st, my birthday, though I won't be there, at the Damrosch Bandshell on West 62nd Street, a Turning the Tables live mega concert, first come, first served, totally free, with I'm With Her, Phoebe Bridgers, Mitski, Jamila Woods, and Carly Rae Jepsen.
What? That's amazing.
It is going to be an amazing concert event. I'm so, so excited about this project. It's just going to be a tremendous selection of writing that I'm enormously excited about. And of course, God, if you can make it to those events, make it to those events. Turning the Tables 2 launches Monday, July 30th.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Guy Branum is a friend of mine, friend of the show. And what I'm about to say would be true even if those two things were not true. He's got a book coming out next Tuesday. It's called My Life as a Goddess. Now, a lot of comedians write books, right? They transcribe their bits or they write these kind of disjointed cultural critic things that don't really hang together because they're used to communicating verbally in bits, not at length in prose. The takeaway here isn't comedian wrote a book. The takeaway here is there is a new writer that you need to read. On a prose level, just line by line, this thing is a joy to read, but it's part memoir, part essay, part cultural criticism. It's very thoughtful and very wise about things like otherness. You know, he's a gay guy, I'm a gay guy. Obviously, those parts of the book are relatable to me, but I think he talks so smartly about being in the world, just being in the world if you look and think and act differently than your environment. And when you're in an environment that doesn't exactly nurture those aspects of yourself that you find to be very central, very core. Also, it's got a lot of funny footnotes. So I'm a sucker for funny footnotes. Now, I've read some reviews that are like, he dishes dirt on Hollywood, which, yeah, I mean, sure, that's some of that, but it's about so much more than that. And I'm not just saying that because I wish I wrote it, although I do. So that is Guy Branum's My Life as a Goddess, coming out Tuesday, July 31st.
Thank you very much. Or as I like to pronounce it, my life is a goddess.
Sure.
I put that little English on it just for Guy.
Nice.
Because we love him so much. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Well, Linda, Glenn, Stephen, you know what a thing that I like is? Big blockbuster movies.
You don't
I
say.
I really do. If you live somewhere where you can get your hands on a copy of the Washington City Paper, or it's considerably much more widely distributed online equivalent, on August 3rd, I will have an oral history of our Uptown Theater on Connecticut Avenue here in Washington, D.C. coming out. This is our one surviving kind of historic movie palace. It is over 80 years old. It is the first place where 2001 A Space Odyssey was shown in 1968. It was the theater where everyone saw Star Wars here in 1977, if you were of age to go to movies in 1977. The great and good Bob Mondello helped me out with this story a lot, telling me about himself going down to see this movie, How the West Was Won, in Cinerama at this theater during its brief life as a Cinerama venue. But it's pretty much the one theater we've still got in town here that has survived through many different eras of movie-going habits and social changes, and through the riots in the 60s and all this stuff. So it was really fun to talk to people about the history of this beautiful theater that I love very much. That will be in the Washington City Paper and online on August 3rd.
Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. I went back and forth about what I was going to talk about, but I have landed on the show Making It on NBC, which is coming up on the 31st of July. That will be premiering. Making It is a crafting competition hosted by Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman. And it is very much modeled after the Great British Bake Off. With the exception of the fact that instead of baking, the people do any variety of crafts. They make wood crafts, they make sewing things, they make paper mache. And as you can imagine, a lot of the appeal of this show is watching Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman, who worked for years on Parks and Recreation, back together again. They have exactly the chemistry that you would anticipate. I think it's a little stronger on hosting and a little weaker on the ability to actually meaningfully evaluate the craft projects because there are judges, but it's not as technical as Bake Off in terms of, if you do this, the frosting will be grainy, the thing that Glenn always likes so much about Bake Off. But it is delightful. Of course, Nick Offerman is legitimately a very, very experienced woodworker and kind of crafting guy in that regard. So he's no fooling about this. She kind of plays the role of the person who doesn't know anything. They are great, great fun. And if you are looking for something that is just light as a feather in your summer, look for Making It on NBC. Also, two of my favorites are coming back on Food Network. Great Food Truck Race, talked about very early in the history of Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Kids Baking Championship. Both are about to come back on Food Network. Both are great. So if you were looking for good froth this summer, that's a bunch of good froth in the crafting and making space.
All four of us picked things for What's Making Us Happy that are not out yet.
That's right.
What will people do this weekend?
That's right. What will they do this weekend? They will go and see great, great action scenes in Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible, here we go again.
Or they will go see, exactly, Mamma Mia, here we go again. Thank you so much for all being here. It is the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Chris at C.T. Klimek. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino. You can find our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music that you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here with me to talk about everything good.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.